Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to episode number 40 of the Free Cities Podcast. Today's guest is a gentleman by the name of Casey Given. Now, Casey is the president and executive director of Young Voices, which is a non-profit agency that aims to cultivate the next generation of libertarian thought leaders in policy journalism and academia, or, as Casey himself describes it, a talent agency for heterodox thinkers. Now, Casey has an interesting connection with the Free Cities movement through his undergrad student days at UC Berkeley, where he hosted a number of prominent seasteaders at the university's Libertarian Club, which he also founded himself. In this conversation, we discuss the strategy that Young Voices takes for creating change in the media, both the legacy version and the new media landscape of sound bites and social influencers, etc. I'm also lucky enough to get some excellent advice from Casey on the best way to get the Free Cities narrative out there. All in all, this is a great conversation if, like me, you are sincerely interested in getting good ideas out there and having a direct impact on hearts and minds. So many thanks to Casey for being so candid with his answers and for being so accommodating with his time. Don't forget, you can send your comments and suggestions to me via Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Getter, LinkedIn. Just mention me in the message. Or if you prefer to meet in person, well, get yourself to the beautiful city of Prague on the 14th and 15th of October for our annual conference and social get-together. Or alternatively, if you're just here to enjoy the discussion, well, I will suggest to you that you just sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Casey Given. Maybe you could introduce yourself and tell me the main things that you currently are involved in.
Yeah, so Young Voices is the one and only main thing. So I'm president and executive director of Young Voices.
Right. Okay. So all the other things I found were then previous.
Yeah.
It's hard to tell on the internet. It has to be said.
Yeah.
I want to read. A statement here from the Young Voices website, which is your kind of like headline. It says, a non-profit talent agency and PR firm for a rising generation of heterodox thinkers. Now, what I find interesting about that, I've got a few questions surrounding that. Number one is that a new thing then? Like, there's been talent agencies and these kind of PR agencies in the past. Would you say that this is the first time it's been specifically for, well, I think here you call them heterodox thinkers. How would you describe the clientele that you have and the people that you work with?
Yeah, well, so Young Voices is unique in that we've kind of flipped the traditional talent agency model in that we don't charge our customers. We operate off of the generosity of donors. So in that sense, we're able to bring in a variety of different voices and empower them. And recently, we've been using the word heterodox because we've been over for years of debate of, should we say liberty, classical liberal, neoliberal? You know, there's all these terms floating around. And ultimately, we'd like to take a big tent approach in welcoming everyone who broadly has a classical liberal framework, whether they identify as libertarian, conservative, market liberal, et cetera. So we've kind of used the term heterodox kind of as a code for not liberal, you know, if anything, to welcome all different types of folks.
I like the word heterodox, but it does suggest that I mean, heterodox just means different opinions, isn't that mm-hmm. right? The actual definition of it.
Yeah.
What I'm alluding to here is that's showing us that the mainstream is not liberal, classical liberal, as you call it, or libertarian. So having worked in the media for many years, I can kind of agree with that. I think most of my colleagues in the past have been of a certain political leaning. Is that your experience as well? Is that why you would call these kind of ideas heterodox?
Yeah, I think so. I think, we try to cultivate a culture of people who are open to debate, open to different ideas. And to the degree that we interact with media, in terms of pitching op-eds, radio and TV, it seems like the term heterodox is more acceptable in the mainstream, at least liberal coded in the sense that, journalists, producers, et cetera, are theoretically open to free speech and open dialogue. And so we're so much more approachable with the term heterodox than openly saying, we're conservatives or libertarians or whatnot.
Okay. So maybe you should break down, give me the 101 on what Young Voices actually does then.
Yes. So specifically what we're doing on a daily basis is editing and pitching op-eds, scheduling broadcast interviews, that's TV, radio, podcasts, and public speaking engagements as well. Recently, in fact, we just launched a speakers bureau for immigrants who escaped tyrannical countries called the Dissident Project, as an example, to get them in front of high schools across the U.S. and different civic groups as well. So we're kind of a full-fledged talent agency, which is why we like that term, just using the nonprofit model, looking for the rising leaders for liberty and empowering them to take the next steps in their career.
And this, if I'm not mistaken, this arose out of Students for Liberty.
Yes, it did. Yeah.
It was a project at Students for Liberty, was it?
It was, yeah. So I came up through Students for Liberty originally as an undergraduate at UC Berkeley, believe it or not.
Wow.
Started a libertarian club there. And SFL started Young Voices in 2013. So we're actually about to hit our 10-year anniversary as a project. And originally it was meant to bring up Students for Liberty leaders in the media, but we quickly realized that there was lots of different folks engaged in think tanks around the world, budding journalists, academics, et cetera, who also had this demand for professional development, to get published, to get their ideas out there. And so Young Voices expanded our audience to welcome them and spun off in 2016 because we realized that this mission was bigger than just students.
And how do you find your Young Voices then? Do they come to you, or do you, hang out at places like the LibertyCon? How do you find these guys and girls?
Yeah, word of mouth has always been our best friend. I think, going to an event like this, like LibertyCon, you just make so many organic connections. We also have a referral program for our current writers to bring in new voices. We really like those kind of personal references. But, frankly, since we're offering services, which typically people would charge thousands of dollars for completely free to our writers, we get a pretty high demand. We run two application rounds a year for our contributor program, which is our main program, and we almost always get over 100 applications each round.
And what do they have to do in that application? Say I'm a budding heterodox thinker.
Mm-hmm.
I am, but I'm a bit too old probably for your organization. But how do I impress?
Yeah, so the main points of the application are really kind of ideological questions to make sure that you're a fit. We try to gauge interest areas of what they would be writing and commentating about. But the crux of it is really an unpublished writing sample that's original, as well as a short 1 to 2 minute video just introducing yourself and as an applicant and why you're interested in joining Young Voices. So we really try to get a sense of both writing as well as verbal communication skills.
So I was going to say, writing is it at the core of what you were expecting from your applicants?
Yes, writing is at the core, because we found that the way to get into TV broadcast, kind of to develop yourself as an influencer at first, is to establish yourself as knowledgeable in a certain subject, which is best to do through writing.
That's interesting, because I've worked in legacy media for years. I now probably look back at that time and see everything that I thought was wrong with it. Mm-hmm. What I've noticed of late and in the sort of like contemporary media is that writing is becoming less important. That's my impression of it. And especially even in the last 2 months, we've started using AI a lot more.
Yeah.
And it's starting to occur to me that writing might be really... many people might not be reading things anymore when AI can literally sort of summarize something and tell you what it is. What do you think about that? I mean, is it something you think about?
Yeah, it is something, we always try to be on the cutting edge at Young Voices, and there certainly is a shift happening. Traditional commentary, journalism reporting is, I feel like, getting shorter and shorter. People are looking for more blog type digest posts like you see on Substack or newsletters, etc. So, we try to evolve our program as well to reflect that. In terms of, AI, I feel like we're on the cusp of a revolution. So we'll yet to see how it evolves. But my projection, my thought would be that there's still always going to be a demand for human analysis, for smart people commentating, for the rest of time. So that's really what we're trying to get, is find those rising best writers and help them get opportunities. Now, maybe that means there will be less jobs out there, and we'll have to shift our program and perhaps take a more elite approach in finding the very best and brightest who can succeed in this world. But I think will always be around.
I'm not sure there'll be less jobs. My experience of the media, having, I started in the late 90s, and I've kind of gone through the whole digital process, mm-hmm. from start to finish. I began as an analog photojournalist, and I've ended up really in the realm of just ideas, like just speech. I mean, I think the revolution is speech, the ability to transmit this conversation to thousands of people and them actually listen to it. That's a pretty, the internet was the thing that facilitated that. But I don't think there'll be less jobs. They'll definitely be different. I mean, what have you found is the best avenue through which your talent gets to sort of spread the ideas that you all believe in?
So the best avenue really is, it starts with writing again, is that we want to make sure that our folks can write well, because even if they don't pursue journalism media, it's just an incredibly helpful skill, because most professionals can't form a sentence very well. So we always like to say to be ahead of your competition is writing. But once you, it's specifically in commentary and journalism, once a writer establishes themselves as being competent on commenting or reporting on a subject, and consistent of not just doing a one and done, but writing every week or perhaps every day, that is usually a great avenue. And almost always, I mean, honestly, just consistency is as Woody Allen said, 80% of life is just showing up. That puts you in so much more competition or ahead of competition and opens up a lot of opportunities. We have even writers I would consider, just kind of slightly above average, have we've been able to get pretty great contributorships, even jobs at media outlets, because they're competent and because they're consistent.
I agree with that 100%, showing up. It's like a little life hack, and no more obvious than in podcasting as well, because almost, unless you are a well-known person who starts a podcast, every podcast goes through a similar curve, and many of them sit at you know, few views for a long time, and then something happens and then it starts gaining traction.
Right.
And you really do have to do it every you have to set yourself a goal and say, you know, every, as in my case, every Friday we put out a video without fail. Fortunately, in the case of this podcast, it's useful that it's someone else's podcast. Because if it was my own, it would be the responsibility to keep doing it lies solely at my feet. And that's also something that I think is very difficult to teach people. I think a lot of people, especially young people, are thirsty for that life, and they'll go ahead and do it. What about the actual some examples of your talent, like, and where you've placed them or how you've educated or inspired them? Can you give me some examples?
Absolutely. Since we've been around for 10 years, we have plenty of great examples. Some of our most famous alumni are folks like Brad Palumbo and Hannah Cox, who recently founded their own media nonprofit called Based Politics, and are frequently seen debating and on you know, top national outlets. I think Brad was recently on Dr. Phil, which I find funny, which is a big like daytime program that bored housewives watch in the U.S. He also just debated Michael Knowles on transgenderism, so very spicy topic. And so we've been able to Hannah Cox as well is huge, has amassed a huge following. So we've been able to get folks to really pursue that path in more traditional punditry. We've also had folks who have gone into more traditional reporting. One of our most recent alumni who's done well is a young man named Nate Hockman, who is a reporter for National Review, and actually just left to become a speechwriter for Governor Ron DeSantis, as an example. So, you know, potentially could be on the White House one day, as well as folks in academia. We've had a number of professors we've helped out. One is Alexander Salter, who's a professor at Texas Tech, who recently got a book deal with Cambridge University Press, but we helped him get into the Wall Street Journal. I think he's been in over a dozen times. So those are some of the avenues we help in policy journalism and academia. And in terms of media outlets specifically, some of the best, the top we get are Wall Street Journal, USA Today, and TV, Fox News, CNN, MSNBC. We're also pretty active in the UK, so BBC, Sky News, and number of different outlets on over there and in Europe as well.
Just out of interest, how important, you obviously think getting into the what we call the mainstream media is an important part of this. My mind is slowly changing on that, you know, and I wonder what your opinion on this would be. I mean, for example, I look at the way I consume media. I never go to the Wall Street Journal or the BBC. I used to work for the BBC. I never go there for my news. I go to something like Twitter, or I go directly to the absolute source, you know, the most expert person on it, who's probably talking about it on a podcast for an hour rather than a short headline in the BBC or something. So when often people will say, oh, but why aren't the mainstream news covering this story, for example, which often you hear. And I can think, well, does it really matter? Like, for example, is Joe Rogan covering it?
Right.
You know, that's more important, yeah. I think. So what do you think about that? Like, are you, number one, do you think there's any truth in that? And number two, are you thinking about, you know, inspiring, or do you inspire your talent also to sort of go down those avenues?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we are seeing a major evolution when it comes to the media. It seems like the quote-unquote mainstream media, more so people who do consume it, are consuming it more or less for confirmation bias. You know, whether that be tuning into Fox News or MSNBC or, you know, even some of the main media outlets like our newspapers like New York Times, you know, you're probably a liberal, et cetera, and it's going to confirm your ideas. So in terms of like where true heterodox type thinkers are, or where true, you can get more unfiltered truth about a certain story, you know, things like Twitter and other new platforms like Substack are really interesting and disrupting, as well as, of course, podcasts. You know, Joe Rogan gets millions of more viewers than CNN ever does. So that's something that is definitely a new evolution in the media. In terms of young voices, you know, we've done some experiments, especially with podcasts. We have had in the past a program called our Podcast Accelerator Program, getting new voices into these alternative mediums. But, you know, frankly, this is something, to be honest, that there's so much more we can do, and we're kind of assessing how to do that, because it is a constantly shifting media landscape that really is it's hard to build an institution around it, and more, you know, it's more about empowering individual creators. So we're kind of assessing how to empower those creators.
What's your personal background? You said you came into this through Students for Liberty.
Yes. So
how did you even hear about Students for Liberty, for example?
Yeah. So I'm from Northern California originally, and I graduated high school in 2008, which, you know, in American politics was an election year. So I learned about libertarianism through watching the Republican primary debate, where Ron Paul kind of famously took on Rudy Giuliani and a lot of these, you know, clowns that were on the stage, and was the fan favorite. And that turned me on to libertarianism. And when I went to Berkeley, I got in touch with Students for Liberty, started a libertarian chapter there. And that kind of got me politically engaged. Out of college, I moved to D.C., to work for a few different policy nonprofits for a few years, and ultimately Students for Liberty, which is how Young Voices was founded.
What are the ideals that you're most interested in finding in your talent? Are there any specifics? I think that I know what the current important buzzwords are amongst youngsters. It's things like the environment. It's things like it's a lot of it's the environment, actually, when I think about it. It's one of the biggest things that I see and think youngsters, from what my sort of personal experience, seem to care about. What are the main things that they're talking about?
Oh, absolutely. It's true. I think particularly, I forget who said it, but I like the metaphor that environmentalism is like a watermelon. It's green on the outside, but red on the inside. I think this is really how progressives, kind of people with more socialist attitudes, are kind of using the facade of environmentalism to push their agenda. And so I think it's important for people who are more free market oriented to have a stake in that conversation, and have a stake not being denialist and saying, oh, climate change isn't real, et cetera, but proposing market forward approaches, which is, you know, that's one of the main topics these days that we really are pushing some of our writers to comment on is proposing free market approaches. But besides environmentalism, you know, we talked about tech earlier. I think tech innovation is always consistently going to be, you know, it seems like every week we're seeing potential disruptions happening, you know, ChatGPT and AI of recent. So that's been one of our main topics that we've had for years, is plenty of writers commenting on lots of pressing topics of the day. Those are probably the two biggest ones of interest to our writers recently.
And I mean, with regards to tech innovation then, do you mean just getting involved in new tech, for example, with the environmental one, you've got an idea there to inspire in other people. But with tech, is it just, what are you saying about tech?
Yeah, so we cover, I mean, we're very thorough with tech, you know, in terms of subtopics, you know, and we touch upon things like content moderation, like antitrust, kind of how governments regulate tech companies, big and small, you know, 5G, broadband, you know, down to the infrastructure, physical infrastructure of that is what we do. Probably the more interesting questions that, you know, we've touched upon of recently is things like AI, like the future of work, how this is going to influence society. But we really, you know, at Young Voices, don't try to take a partisan approach on things and just have our writers explore these ideas. You know, some of my favorite pieces are also kind of how humans interact with technology and how it's kind of shaping our media landscape and shaping how we interact with each other. I find just the whole subject so fascinating.
Well, that me too. And let's talk about it because I have three children. They're not quite old enough yet to be. Well, we don't allow them to interact with social media, and we, you know, but I know from my friends who have teenagers and beyond that the way that they interact as groups is radically different from the way I did as a kid. What's your experience? What are you hearing and seeing from your sort of young influences and your young voices?
Yeah, I think one thing that's pretty interesting, and we've certainly seen it in, I think, coming out of the pandemic, is just how tuned in everyone as well, tuned into a certain narrative. I think that's something that can be incredibly powerful in connecting people, but also very scary when you have, you know, government, you know, more coercive influences, you know, trying to shut things down or whatnot, or spread a certain message. I mean, I think we've all have had plenty of friends who went a little crazy during the pandemic and just followed every sort of government propaganda with no questions asked. But you see corollaries to that in politics, frankly. You know, it's not just about government authoritarianism where people, you know, just go full-fledged on some of these, you know, partisanship and whatnot. And it really is, I feel like people are using technology as a conduit to really find a sense of being, is, you know, tuning into a certain community or getting their values, being a partisan or you know, even different subgroups and whatnot. So I find that very fascinating, and our writers are really doing that, are writing about that, of both the pros and the cons of technology, and how we can really learn to live with this alien, as David Bowie called it. He had a great interview in the late 90s about, you know, when people didn't really understand what the internet was. He's like, this is like an alien being just landed on Earth, and we're learning how to deal with it. And I find those conversations very fascinating.
Do you have anyone writing on the idea that online communities are forming in real life? But because this has been my actual experience, especially since during the pandemic, it really ramped up. That was one of the first times I actually actively went online to connect with people. And what's happened since is many of those people that I connected with, I now connect with in real life. And I mean, I have a theory that in the far distant future, many communities will be coming together which did meet online. I think that's correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's the new arena for community. But it's not, in my experience, it's not enough to just have it online. I think you need a physical manifestation of it. I'm just wondering if anyone has been writing about that idea.
Nobody really comes to mind off the top of my head, but that would be interesting. Is that, you know, the first thought that comes to me is, you know, the famous book, Robert Putnam's book, Bowling Alone, and basically how he had kind of a pessimistic take, is that people are getting more atomized and individualized, and really on the, he wrote it in the cusp of the internet, and saying, you know, like, this could maybe make people even more isolated, but in many ways, you know, to sound more of an optimist, I mean, I think something like we've seen with Students for Liberty, I mean, I'm always inspired. I just came from the registration hall. The conference hasn't even started yet of, you know, so many of these people met online and are genuinely, especially in Europe, as an American, I love coming over here because politics in smaller countries like Portugal here are so dynamic. And, you know, Students for Liberty alumni are already in the parliament here as well. And that's, you know, probably a large part because of the internet, is because of forming these collections of, you know, random libertarians scattered across the country, various countries, coming together at conferences like this. So I think that there is kind of a positive thing for community, especially coming out of the pandemic. I think people have realized that just complete online life is not what it's marked up to be.
Yeah, I think you're right there. I think as a sort of, to push back on that though, I think mm-hmm. as we go into the future, I think the temptation to spend more of your time online will probably get bigger. I think even when we look at it now, it's like, it's pretty hard to resist the online world. But I think we're only just at the start. I mean, Elon hasn't plugged anyone into to Neuralink yet, but almost certainly when they do, that online experience, the ability for you and me to have this conversation in cyberspace in a very probably hyper-realistic way, it's going to be very tempting to do that. My concern or my wonder is whether or not that will be a lesser experience. I believe I'm old school. I think meeting in person is irreplaceable. I think it's really important. But then again, I've spent my whole life meeting people in person, and I don't like talking to people on right. Zoom. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
But I don't know. Do youngsters make that same discrepancy? Do you think?
You know, I'm gonna show my age at 33. I don't consider myself an expert on what, particularly Zoomers, you know, younger people more in the 18 to 25 range, are. I know I've seen some data that do show some concerning trends, that there's less interest in leaving home and, you know, starting businesses, etc. So maybe that is kind of a negative attitude, is that people are kind of more, younger people could be more satisfied and just kind of tuning out. But it does seem like at least how they use the internet, there seems to be less focus on, you know, public pontification on things like Facebook or Twitter and whatnot, and more of that in-person interaction on, you know, different messaging platforms and stuff. So maybe there will be hope for more in-person interaction and using the internet to form those personal connections instead of just pontification and comparison and virtue signaling and trolling and all the negative things we see about the internet, because they've seen how that's driven their parents crazy, and their millennial parents who are vain and obsessed with their online image. So yeah.
So are you saying then that that generation, the newest generation, aren't as narcissistic or whatever you want, you know, obsessed with themselves?
I mean, I think the verdict, it's too early to tell, but perhaps.
What about then, how long have you been in the Students for Liberty world yourself?
Yes, for a long time. I joined in 2009. So
okay, so talk to me about how the landscape of the liberty world in youngsters then has changed since 2009. What have you noticed?
Oh, this is my absolute favorite topic to talk about. Even though I'm still in my early 30s, it seems like I've been around for, you know, going on my second decade in the liberty movement and started an organization. So I've been following this quite intimately. In terms of the landscape, you know, I think there's positives and negatives. So the positives in terms of where we're at now compared to when I joined, you know, coming up on, what is that, almost 15 years ago, is that there's a lot more organizations, there's a lot more efforts. You know, we're seeing more activation in different countries in terms of like Students for Liberty is active in more countries than ever. And other groups like the Atlas Network, for example, which is a great consortium of think tanks across the world, you know, in terms of the budgets of these groups, you know, there's more resources than ever, and more interest in the ideas than ever, I would say broadly. At the same time, you know, I think there is, especially as someone, as a fundraiser, I frequently talk to donors who are in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and sometimes they express disappointment that, you know, we've been investing and we've seen so much, you know, there are some good signs, but you know, there's really not many mass popular movements for libertarian ideas, or at least not as much as people would have hoped. We've seen, you know, there was some sprinkles of hope in countries like Brazil, where, you know, where there was like a libertarian populist movement, at least at first. But oftentimes these ideas have, these kind of sparks have gone in the more traditional right-wing way, or in some cases like Hungary or whatnot, even more concerningly in a nationalistic kind of proto-fascist way. So, there's pros and cons to where we're at. It's a very interesting time for the libertarian movement.
So why is that then? I'm going back to what you said about some older donors having to manage their expectations about this, the movement. Well, I suppose, firstly, personally, do you feel the same, or do you think, are you more optimistic? Do you think it's a long game, maybe, or maybe they're expecting things to happen too fast? Or if not, why is it that something that seems so obviously good and right to so many of us is not gaining in popularity?
Yes, I've thought about this for a while. When I was a younger man, you know, when I was 18, just getting interested in libertarian ideas, I thought it was so obvious. I was like, oh, you know, everyone is really secretly a libertarian if they think about it long enough. You know, everyone is socially liberal, fiscally conservative, you know, live and let live. And I've actually shifted away from that idea in the sense that humans are remarkably tribal, I would say, is probably the explanation in one sentence, is that people, you know, that's really how we survived in the wild, is, you know, we're actually physically remarkably weak beings, but it's through our knowledge of and are able to collaborate and work together that we've become, you know, the dominant species on the planet, to take it from a basic biological level, is because we're able to group together and do things. So that's our nature. And, you know, but, you know, in terms of how it manifests negatively, is that people, communities form because through tribalism, by defining themselves, you know, against the other, you know, as Carl Schmitt said, you know, politics, you know, the politics is the definition of the friend enemy distinction of who is your enemy. And so it's very hard to create a new group of that, of libertarians, to overcome this kind of right left dichotomy, or, you know, and I know in different countries the tribalists can, the tribes can be different. And so I think that's really the explanation that I try to take to donors. It's hard to overcome this tribalism. And instead, I think as a political strategy, it almost makes more sense for libertarians, at least in the United States, to link themselves to one party or another and kind of work in that existing infrastructure and promote pro-liberty ideas. And that's why, at least at Young Voices, I'm more interested in influencing the meta conversation and influencing different groups, whether they be Democrats or Republicans, to promote pro-liberty ideas.
I suppose pro-liberty ideas don't belong to libertarians in a way.
Right.
I was just thinking about it as you were speaking then, thinking who's more likely to adopt a pro-liberty idea. But when you look back historically, both left and right have ideas of liberty, I think. You know, free speech, for example, good example. It's been a left-wing idea in my world for a long time. And now it's really gone the other way, it appears to anyway. So what I suppose I'm asking is, why is it that the left and right rose and not the left and liberty or the right and liberty? why is it necessary to sort of infiltrate one or other of those? Are they naturally occurring human conditions or something? The people on the left and the people on the right, or are they, like you say, just two tribes?
Yeah, I think Jonathan Haidt, the social psychologist, has really done probably the best work on that, of analyzing the type of values that people who identify as liberal and conservative have. Broadly, according to him, liberals are more interested in equality and fairness. That's kind of their main focus, whereas conservatives are more interested in order. Some reason, that's just kind of the way that the tribes have seemed to formulate. Whereas libertarianism, it really is an acquired taste. Libertarians are, Haidt analyzes them and finds that we are a much more analytical bunch, kind of less interested in social decorum or kind of the social tribalist, and more individualistic and autonomous in that sense. So I think in that we're kind of like the philosopher kings in some sense, not to flatter ourselves too much, but in that sense, I think that it's important for us to operate among the masses kind of as these secret agents or anything, as kind of pushing these pro-liberty ideas in Team Red or Team Blue. And we've seen this in there's been ebbs and flows throughout the years of Democrats or Republicans adopting pro-liberty ideas. But recently, I think on the left, I think it's really cool what you're seeing, particularly in the U.S., but I'm sure elsewhere as well, the YIMBY movement, which is Yes in My Backyard, of a lot of Democrats realizing that, particularly in the United States, there's tremendous problems with cost of living, and the only way to improve that is to actually build. And there's kind of, among mainstream Democrats, and especially in Silicon Valley now, an interest in building and making bureaucracies more, facilitate more innovation and actual just physical infrastructure, not crumbling, and building new housing and supplies and whatnot. So I would hope that more people embrace these kind of pro-liberty ideas, even if they identify as traditional liberals or progressives.
Does that mean you think that the pro-liberty movement's never going to be a large player in this? It's always going to be something that whispers in the ear of the Reds or the Blues?
I think, at least, to speak for my country, I think I've come to the conclusion that in my lifetime, at least, there won't be a mass, popular libertarian party. Perhaps it's different in other countries. I think in Europe especially, there are parties that are more explicitly classical liberal. I feel like in the U.S., when you tell most Americans, like, classical liberal, they just don't understand what that means at all. I think, at least in the United States, the two-party duopoly will probably persist for a long time, as it has for, over 100 years. And that's really, I think, where libertarians need to be more operatives.
So you're in favor of influencing them rather than necessarily creating a new... Well, it is a movement, but you're more interested in inserting yourself in the current system. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. Just influencing the dialogue. I think broadly, that's what Young Voices is trying to do. Both left and right is really push pro-liberty ideas, because we are at an interesting time in the world where I think that the Francis Fukuyama kind of end of history thesis has shown to be wrong. And, Freedom House and all of these big type of think tanks who measure freedom of the world have shown in recent years that it is declining. So broadly, I think it's most important right now to have messengers to say, like, hey, we have a really great thing going in the West, at the very least, and to the degree that even Eastern countries have been able to develop, it's been because of adopting many pro-liberty ideas, at least in the economic sphere. So we don't want to go backwards. We don't want to collapse into war and collapse into, you know, authoritarianism, fascism, you know, the kind of the negative ideologies that we've seen in the early half of the 20th century, but, you know, centuries and centuries of war before that. So I think it's important to both on the left and right and in lots of different countries promote these pro-liberty ideas in a way that that makes sense for the local context.
Do you happen to know, like, when I it's funny to think that being pro-liberty is a minority idea, unless, like you say, people actually don't even know what it means, don't even think about it. It's not something they've ever considered, or they just consider themselves to be free, say. But it is a strange thing to be against. And I know there is, I've heard from other people anyway, that there is a kind of rising ideology against freedom, against the notion that that freedom should be the natural state of life, let's say. Is that something you know of or have heard of? Or?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I mean, I think you see this on the far elements of both the left and the right, you know, on the left in terms of more socialistic ideas that, you know, people think that if there were more command and control, there would be less societal problems, less poverty, etc. But on the right as well, in terms of more culture, I think that's something that you're seeing a lot of interest in national conservative ideas, because people are thinking like, well, we're living in a secularized society and people are filling their God-shaped hole with alcoholism, addiction, you know, et cetera, unemployment. And so therefore we need to push kind of religion or kind of these nationalistic ideas. You know, I have more faith in humanity. I think we're kind of in an existential moment, but it's never been a better time to be alive. You know, frankly, in terms of when people want to turn back the clock, that's always the question to ask them is, well, when? You know, people are often nostalgic for like the 60s or the 50s or whatnot, at least in the United States. And it's like, well, that wasn't a great time to be a woman. It wasn't a great time to be black. I'm personally gay, so it wasn't a great time to be gay, even as a white man. And so I think that it's important to emphasize, even though we don't live in a completely free world, it's important to emphasize just the tremendous freedom and opportunity that we do have here. I mean, you know, heaven can be now if we just, you know, really embrace the freedom and opportunity we have.
Can you go a little bit deeper into describing this existential moment we're in? I agree with you. I think maybe describe it in as detail as you can, and then give me the two timelines that sort of manifest in the future, the one that you want and the one that probably you don't want, you know.
Yeah, well, in terms of, you know, some of the causes of the existential moment is a lot of kind of big cultural institutions have been on the decline for many years. You know, we talked about religion. That's one that people kind of feel valueless, or they're not sure how to get their values. And that's maybe why we're seeing a lot of over-politicized people, you know, trying to get their values from being a Trump supporter or trying to get their values from being a Bernie bro, et cetera. But in terms of other things as well, you know, I think work, the evolution of work, and, you know, in certain countries, more people out of work and kind of less defined jobs that are, you know, kind of people can be company men and assure that they will have a guaranteed income and retire generously, you know, especially with the evolution of the gig economy, you know, as well as discourse. I mean, media, that's what I'm constantly thinking about, is that there's just more different narratives being floated out there. There's not the Walter Cronkite, you know, at least in the US, where there was one big newsman that was the trusted voice of America and whatnot. So I think all of these things, there's just so much more noise today and so many more paths to take, good paths and dark paths as well. And so that's probably why, to tie it into the previous question, some people are like, there's too much freedom. People need less options. They need, you know, simpler paths to be put forward. But I would say that freedom is a good thing. Ultimately, is that These paths are more open, particularly for the poor, for minorities, etc. There's so many more opportunities, and it's a better world to live with this abundance of choice than to live with narrow choices that choices only existed really if you were fit into certain categories. But we are, at least my moment of optimism in terms of the positive path to take is that this is really new, is that this evolution, both economically, but also with the internet, to tie it into previous conversations. I mean, we're really at just like 20, 30 years after the printing press was invented, is the equivalent. And, you know, nobody looks back at the printing press and is like, oh man, we should have just stopped the clock there. So I think that humans will learn how to develop and learn how to learn to adopt to these new realities and ultimately find peace and happiness. Because, you know, there is truly, for people who choose to find it, it's never been a more happier and prosperous time to be alive.
Hallelujah. I mean, it's true. When you look at the revolution that's happened, the internet, it's a revolution of information. And the three things that you kind of homed in on then, religion and information and the evolution of work, are all tied into that same thing. The evolution of work is happening because information is destroying the middleman in many places, in many worlds. So yeah, it is. It's an explosion of information. And I suppose it is confusing. It's complete chaos at the moment. What I was thinking was, how do you advise young people to navigate the chaos of what's going on at the moment? Because I think for them, it's just life. It's just normal. But for me, I know the difference between when I was 10 years old. In where I lived, there were two TV channels, BBC One and BBC Two, and mm-hmm. that was it. There was Radio One and Radio Two and mm-hmm. Radio Three. You know, yeah. That was it. You know, like there was no checking things. I had to look in books to find stuff out. There was none of that instant gratification of information, of this, of ideas. You know, everything moved very slowly. So for me, I look at it now. I'm adapting. I'm trying my best to not be overwhelmed, and I'm working out my own policies for trying to find the truth and what works and what's good for everyone. You know, but it is complete chaos. Mm-hmm. It's the free market of ideas. It's the and in your business, in the news, in the media, it's been completely democratized in that sense. How do you best advise youngsters to navigate this chaos?
Yeah, that's a great question. I feel like there really needs to be more kind of introductory like lessons particularly for young people, how to deal with the internet, to how to deal with the abundance of choice and noise. How I would advise them is, you know, number one, you can, you know, basic things, you can't trust everything you see on the internet. It's funny, you know, I was reflecting on this, and you see this in Twitter especially, is that this was a common saying in the 90s, which was actually a very healthy attitude. But now it seems like the boomers have kind of lost this and trust everything they see on the internet. But it is a true great axiom, is like, You know, be skeptical of everything that you see on the internet. Two, you know, I think it's important psychologically, particularly for girls. It's, you know, you see a lot of data coming out about this, is that you don't get yourself your sense of self from your image or comparing yourself to others on the internet. I think that's important, is that, you know, you. Is just to formulate real life connections matter so much more than internet connections, and finding, you know, a sense of happiness and being from your friends, from your family, from your loved ones, boyfriend, girlfriend, is so much more important than anonymous strangers online. Be professional. I think that's important. Particularly, actually, probably I would say the worst are more not the Zoomers, but millennials and you know, Gen X, Gen X Boomers, who are just kind of constantly pontificating and spewing just all of these half-baked ideas online, is that, you know, I think it's important, particularly with the overabundance of commentary, is to be thoughtful in what your content you put out there is. So, embraces, be curious. I mean, it's from a pure knowledge perspective. I mean, there you can get a free, you know, basically free PhD level education online. So I think it's much more important to be a consumer of information than a producer of information. At least do 80-20 in terms of learning, improving your knowledge and connections. So I think those are basic, you know, four good tips.
Do you have a particular personal opinion on how important it is to go to further education, as in university now?
Oh, yes. Yes, I do. I think about this often as someone who hires frequently, is that I think that it's absolutely true that my experience, when I'm looking at a resume, I honestly don't even, this has happened to me so many times, that I go straight to experience. I don't I don't even look at the education. And sometimes I'll look at the experience. I'm like, oh, okay, they worked at a great company. Oh, they do writing, et cetera. And then I'll look as an afterthought at their education and just see like, oh, they just went to a community college, or sometimes like, oh, they didn't go to college at all. But honestly, it doesn't matter to me, so long as they have been able to show themselves as a competent and consistent worker. Going back to our very first conversation, is that I think that's much more important than, you know, navigating some fancy institution. That's not to say, you know, I went to a fancy school, Berkeley. It definitely has been, I'm sure I've gotten some opportunities because of it that I wouldn't. But honestly, if you can't afford, you know, if I think that especially in the US, like, college is just so ridiculous I think it's important to emphasize that you can have a very successful career without the need to go hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt before you're even of legal drinking age. So I think that's another thing in terms of the work and how this new economy has impacted us, is that people from very humble backgrounds can go on to be great successes without the need for a fancy education.
I agree, and I have this conversation already with my kids, and it's my generation. It was important to go to university. I feel that in most fields now, it's been devalued by there being so much further education. I think when I was young, further education was something that a small number of people did, and it was relatively competitive to get into. Now it's not. It's a money. It's a numbers game. The unis want as many people as possible to, you know.
Yeah.
But obviously, if you want to be a doctor, you have to go to university. If you want to be a lawyer, I think you have to go to university, all those kind of things. It's interesting to hear you say, though, that you don't look at that on resumes. I don't either. I don't care. How, though, would you advise someone young to get experience if they're I'm thinking of fresh out of school, 18, you know, a lot of potential, want to do something, have got, let's say, a libertarian mindset. How do they go ahead and get something? Where do they fit in without any experience? Or are you thinking maybe they should have already been doing stuff when they were at school, which is probably true?
I would say internships and apprenticeships is the way to start in the workforce, is just finding somewhere to work. And someone will take you, and then moving your way up the ladder in terms of looking for other opportunities, maybe that fit more of your interest. I mean, you know, just starting to build that network will create a web of different opportunities that open to you. And so, you know, I've hired, I think, in total, two people full time. That don't have a college degree, and they've both been fantastic workers. And it's really because they accumulated that experience, is that they got internships, apprenticeships, they got full-time jobs, and have references and networks. I mean, truly finding people who can vouch for you that is so much more important than some bureaucrat giving you a college degree. It's a diploma.
So where do you go? I suppose you're probably going to say Students for Liberty is a good place. Students. If you're young and you're liberty minded, you know.
Well, I feel like I'm contractually obliged to plug my organization at this point is Young Voices.
Right.
That's really a place to start is in terms of our main offerings are again, op-ed editing, publishing, commentary is that we've helped get a number of people get jobs because they took themselves seriously. They became knowledgeable in a subject. They wrote regularly and were able to build those relationships, not just in terms of the editing and pitching, but also knowledge is something that we emphasize in our organization. We bring in lots of outside experts from think tanks, et cetera, to give lectures, even do different mentorship pairs, et cetera. So that's something that we try to take a very kind of 360 approach to helping people develop their network and their knowledge.
Something that I picked up on in your previous, what you were previously saying was be professional, talking about youngsters. Can you just elaborate on what you mean by that, be professional? I think I know what you mean. I know a lot of people from certain age groups who don't act in a professional way. Is that what you're talking about? Or maybe you could elaborate.
Yeah, I could. I think... I don't want to sound like a stuffy old man here.
It doesn't matter.
Because professionalism, I feel like, is...
What is it?
Is evolving.
Define professionalism for me.
Maybe I'll start by saying what it's not. Like, I feel like professionalism, people think it's like, oh, what you wear, or that, you know, you need to kind of be a stiff, or, you know, collect as much cards, be a card shark. It's not about that. It's, I think, in the 21st century, we're seeing, you know, a lot more tolerance of for people to look any way, it's really just more about carrying yourself, being curious of making genuine connections and wanting to improve your life and make connections with others where it adds value. I think that's important. You know, of course, there's the basic decorum. Don't be a drunk mess at events or whatnot. All the basics. Don't sexually harass anyone, etc. But I think it's more about being intentional. If I had to summarize it in one word, it's being intentional with your life. Life goes faster than you think, and showing others and yourself that you are putting your best foot forward and that you're intentional with your time, you're intentional with their time, and you want to make genuine connections, and you're a curious person. I think that's how I would define professionalism.
I think that's a brilliant way of describing it. I've never thought of it like that.
Yeah.
It's true, even because I was thinking about things like being on time, for example.
Yeah.
But that's intentionalism. That's you being intentional. I like that. I'm going to use that one if you don't mind.
Absolutely.
That's a really, really fabulous way of thinking about it. Okay, right. Couple more questions. Advise me. The Free Cities Foundation, we're trying to attract people to our ideas, you know, communities, free communities around the world. Advise me on our best practices for reaching people in the media.
Yeah, that's a good question. I was contemplating on Free Cities and kind of marketing, and it seems like a lot of the pushback in countries that projects have kind of gotten stifled is kind of this accusation, this wrongful accusation, I will say, of neocolonialism. So I think that's probably the main challenge of, Free Cities is really trying to market it more in terms of the empowerment and the opportunity of how Free Cities it's not just rich Americans and Westerners coming in to make a quick buck, but it's tremendous opportunities for people living in the countries, people for the poor to raise themselves up and for entrepreneurs. So I would say that that's probably something is really showing the bottom up potential of Free Cities is tremendous. You know, I think of the brilliant Peruvian economist Hernando de Soto talks about dead capital and how, and there's knowledge distributed throughout the world. I mean, there's geniuses in poor countries living in huts and, you know, all over the world, but oftentimes they're not able to really make much of their life because of their dead capital, because their institutions don't allow entrepreneurs to realize their potential, not just for themselves, but for their communities, for the world. So many great inventions can be made that in just poor institutions are suppressing. So I think that really emphasizing that kind of opportunistic and that kind of messaging, social mobility messaging, is what can make free cities really thrive.
I 100% agree with you there. And I mean, I've seen that with my own eyes. We visited, there's a one of the better known projects. It's called Prospera in Honduras. Yes. Mm-hmm. And most of the people there are Honduran. And I don't think a lot of people realize that. I don't quote me on the figure, but I think it's 95% of the people there are Hondurans. And I think the expectation is that it's a gated community. And in fact, in Morazan, I think it's all Honduras. It's all, which is another one, it's all Hondurans. Anyway, I agree with you totally there. It's a PR thing. But what's difficult is without, when you have a working project that shows the results, I think then you have something to really, talk about. Most of the Free Cities projects are works in progress.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You could arguably say that your predicament is the same with your libertarian ideas. They're kind of still a work in progress because there are few libertarian politicians who are actually getting up on stages and saying, look, we need a smaller government and we need these fiscal policies and we need this, you know. And I think when we have maybe this is a dangerous way to think, but when you have a concrete example, maybe you have some concrete examples of libertarian success stories that you use to inspire people.
Yeah. Well, in terms of, you know, to go back to Free Cities first, is that it is a work in progress, but I would say that I think I'm pretty bullish on Free Cities because you're starting to see it seep into popular culture. Even people who don't come from libertarian or kind of those types of backgrounds. I mean, you know, all of the different examples like Akon or even Kanye kind of experimented with some Free Cities thoughts. Or even I just learned about this like a few days ago. Apparently Donald Trump just proposed some sort of like Free Cities idea in the U.S.
He put out tender saying, I want ideas. Yeah. I mean, that was a bit more like the kind of Disney,
right?
The Disney
right.
Village.
What, yeah,
Walt Epcot, Disney. Yeah. Well, no, Walt Disney made a community, didn't he? A white picket fence.
Yeah. Well, you know, it is funny actually that this is a big controversy in the U.S. right now with Disney World and the Governor Ron DeSantis just got like basically tried to screw over what's called the Reedy Creek Development Corporation or whatever it was. That Disney has this special governance kind of zone. But it was originally created because Walt Disney wanted to build essentially a free city, Epcot, the experimental prototypal city of tomorrow, that ultimately, I mean, there's the Epcot amusement park now, but ultimately was supposed to be a type of free city back in the 60s. So it is amazing how long these ideas have been around. And how they're starting to proliferate, even if it is still just kind of in the ideas phase. I think that makes me tremendously optimistic. And in terms of libertarian examples, I mean, it is hard to point to a singular one because there really has not been a fully libertarian society. I mean, you know, not to sound like hackneyed Milton Friedman or something, but Hong Kong, at least until recently, was probably the closest examples that we saw. But, you know, that really shows that economic liberty is not just the end all be all, that you need to have a culture of liberty and strong defenses against tyranny as well.
It's interesting that, so according to you, from what you know of the media landscape and the meme landscape, the idea of free cities is one that's popping up more in popular culture now.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's clear. And also, you know, just the fact that institutionally, I mean, obviously I'm familiar with your foundation, but there's plenty of other free city foundations as well. I'm very close with Mark Lutter, the board of directors of, or the founder of the Charter Cities Institute.
Yeah.
So, and there's plenty of other different types of initiatives going on. So I think that's great, not just in terms of the ideas and kind of the popular influencers like Akon or Trump or whatnot, but institutionally there's a lot more interest in investment in these ideas. So I think that it'll become a reality.
Do you think that's anything to do with the moment that we're currently in? Do you think free cities as an idea could have been resurging as a response to increased pressure or increased authoritarianism? I mean, you said the data shows that the world is getting less free.
Yeah. And I think also to tie it into our earlier conversations about technology and whatnot is maybe this will be kind of the optimistic way that the internet manifests in the real world, is that people, things are becoming much more decentralized. You know, it makes no sense that in a highly decentralized world with an abundance of choice, we really only have a few choices of government, you know, constitutional republic, monarchy, constitutional monarchy, you know, socialist society, you know, what, those are basically the three types of flavors, three or four different types of flavors. So I think that maybe this radical decentralization or, you know, radical federalism, I know that's kind of a term that floats around in political science, will exist some more. And, you know, we've seen this in history too. In many ways, like, you know, if you look at the history of like the Austro-Hungarian Empire or the Holy Roman Empire, is that there was in early history a sense of like, oh, we'll just have our little community and leave it alone and give a little taxes to the king to protect us. Is that I think that more of these ideas, but in a more democratic libertarian way, not in a repressive way, as I'm sure some of those old societies of yesteryear were, will manifest in people in building their own intentional communities, and creating peaceful and prosperous societies.
Yeah. Hallelujah. Once again, I think the only slight difference, because I often end up talking about this, is there are no new frontiers anymore.
Right.
In a way. Mm-hmm. I mean, space is deep sea, I think, the sea. I mean, there, you know about seasteading.
Yes.
Yeah, right. Okay. So the sea is the far out sea, obviously, but I'm not sure many people want to live. Who knows? Me personally, I'm not sure I would want to do that. And nor space. So the problem is finding a frontier where you are unfortunately allowed to have an intentional community, and then through a time, hopefully get more and more autonomy. That's the difficulty, I suppose.
Yeah. From the political side of thing too, because I was pretty close friends, at least in college, with a lot of the seasteading folks, Patry Friedman, and actually lived with a few of their employees back in the day. So it is interesting to see the evolution, because back then free cities was not as big of an idea as it is now. But you know, really what changed, I think, is that not just the ideas evolving and becoming more popular, but also governments becoming interested in them. And I think that's tremendously interesting, is that there's more. Even countries who are not yet really tuned into free cities, there's more demand for competitive governance. You know, we're in Portugal. Portugal has very aggressive campaigns in the United States to get Americans to move to Portugal. And I'm sure this happens all over. You know, I see it, at least in the US with other countries like the Maldives or something, or you know, St. Kitts, like trying to get all of these different investments and people to do that. And so I think that's, we're going to see probably more countries that being the next evolution in it is building these new communities and these free cities, because we do live in a, you know, in a flatter world, and there's no reason that you have to be chained to, you know, just your happenstance of where you happen to be born to. And so I think that's something that more countries will be competing and interested in, bringing all different types of people for living, for entrepreneurship, not even necessarily being physically there. Like Estonia is a great example of e-citizenship, of just getting economic benefits and low taxation and whatnot. So I think there's tremendous opportunity for free cities in the future of competitive governance.
Oh, it's good to hear you say that. That do you think that governments are being incentivized to be competitive?
Yes.
Because that, you know, goes against the grain. I think a lot of you would wonder why,
yeah.
why they would want to be. I'm interested to hear a little bit more about what you, your experiences with Patry and seasteading, and, you know, are you saying you were there around the time of the origin of the ideas, or does that go back a lot further? I don't know a huge amount about it.
Yeah, so the Seasteading Institute was founded in 2008. It kind of famously got its first big grant from Peter Thiel, who has since kind of gone in a very different direction with his ideas. I miss the 2008 Peter Thiel. But I met Patry Friedman in 2010. I hosted him at UC Berkeley, of course, my undergrad. I mean, it was really one of a great formative moments of my life. Looking back, it was really cool. We had it in this building at UC Berkeley that actually had a stained glass window in the back. So Patry kind of at the end went into preacher mode. We had a great crowd. We had about 50 or 100 folks. And so he was like, I'm here to preach the gospel of seasteading and whatnot. So that was really cool. And I met their subsequent executive directors, and we had them a few times at Berkeley. So really fond memories. But of course, many of those people in those circles have come to embrace more free cities ideas and have been involved in Honduras and various other types of ventures like French Polynesia and whatnot, trying to create these competitive governance zones. So it is interesting to see the evolution of those ideas.
Well, yeah. I spoke to his dad last night on this podcast.
Yes,
we did mention seasteading. He wasn't as enthusiastic as Patry. He was more enthusiastic about the free cities model, which I can understand. And I think in my case, when I think about it, it's because maybe I don't understand what a seastead is going to be like. But
yeah,
often I'm thinking, do I want to live out to sea?
But well, you know, Patry actually wrote a very interesting kind of like a Facebook essay. Really, it was hundreds of words about, because in Thailand, what was it, 2 years ago, there was an actual kind of floating seastead that was built. It was actually, although prototypical, a prototype, it was a pretty impressive that they were able to like build it and live on it.
Who was that? Thai people?
Yeah, no, it was an American. I forget his name, but it was an American who lived out there with his Thai girlfriend off the coast of Phuket. And it, within like a week or so, got seized by the Thai Navy, and they had to flee the country. Thailand takes their sovereignty very seriously. They were literally going to try to basically try them for treason, or like trying to challenge the sovereignty of Thailand. And Patry wrote an interesting piece to say, kind of the going through the evolution of his thought with seasteading, is that the concept of international waters is not, it's not like a terra nullis. It's not like nobody controls this land. Maybe technically that's what it is, but there's all of these different shipping rights. There's all of these different, you know, kind of sovereignty, extended sovereignty that countries have even beyond their territorial waters, that they can still operate as a navy and whatnot if they have, you know, you can't just have an armada of ships right outside of, you know, your technical zone. So there really is, at least from my understanding of his post, that there it's very difficult to build a seastead anywhere in a place that is truly international waters. I mean, it would have to be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles off the coast of anywhere. So it's...
I think there are I haven't dipped deeply into it yet because I've not spoken to anyone on this podcast. We're going to America soon, so we'll probably have a lot of conversations about it. But I did watch a few talks at our conference, Liberty in Our Lifetime, in Prague recently. And there are versions of it which are, let's just live offshore kind of thing. Mm-hmm. They're not free cities, but there are these incredible... looking things that are half underwater, half above water. Have you seen not the ones that link together? It's a fascinating.
It has been an idea around for a while. Actually, people don't know this, but Buckminster Fuller actually conceptualized a seastead in the early 1960s, which is interesting. So he was a great builder and inventor of things at the World's Fair and whatnot. So it has been an idea around for a while, but yeah, it's just very difficult both for physical building and also the governance reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, we've been going for over an hour now. So I've got one last question for you before we finish. If you had a one-year sabbatical that was paid for by a benefactor, what would you do in your 1 year?
Oh, I love that question. I would undoubtedly travel the world. I have learned so much about life and kind of, it seems like on every trip I get a different takeaway. So, you know, that would be it is just traveling, I think, particularly in Southeast Asia and Latin America and Europe, really, really interests me. And I would probably try to write, it's been something I've always wanted to, write some sort of book or whatnot, but to give a kind of probably cliche answer, but
what kind of book?
I think along the themes that we talked about of kind of this existential moment we're in and the kind of future of technology of work and of making an optimistic case, because I feel like humans are wired to be pessimistic, and again, going back to our lizard brain, I feel like that's probably comes from our evolution that, you know, we need to kill the woolly mammoth or else our children are going to starve, right? But we live in an era of prosperity that we don't stop to think about our potential, both society's potential, but also our individual potential. And so that's something that I would try to make an optimistic case, not to say that this is inevitable, because we do make choices and society can go backwards, but that we need to embrace both the ideas of liberty and choice to create this future, and that we can live with technology, we can live with kind of the an evolution and evolving economy. Not to say that any of these things are perfect or perfectly bad or perfectly good, but it's really more about humans' attitudes, psychological shift to embrace, to thrive in these new sets of circumstances.
Well, Casey, good luck with your book.
Yeah, my non-existent book.
I'll read it
one day.
and it's been great talking to you. Thanks for coming to see us, and good luck with your talk later. Are you speaking today?
Speaking tomorrow afternoon.
Okay, good luck with that, and thanks for coming.
Thank you.